I am Plant Online. This is the commentary.ca. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, David Bergen. Good morning, Mr. Bergen.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about the retreat. An 18-year-old boy. He's Ojibwe?
He's Ojibwe, yes.
Ojibwe.
And Raymond Seymour.
And he is taken, the book begins in 1973. He's 18 years old. He's taken by a police officer to a remote island to be left for dead. Why?
He is seeing the officer's niece. She's a white girl from Kenora, and he's Ojibwe. And the police officer, Constable Hart, does not see that as a favorable thing. So he tries to convince Raymond first to not do this, and then when he doesn't, he takes him to the island and leaves him there.
We've heard about stuff like this happening in recent years, haven't we? There was that book, The Starlight Tour, I think it was called?
That's right. That's right. And
How common is that experience?
It's happened in Winnipeg, I know that. It's not something that you hear much about, even when it happens. For some reason, it doesn't make the news that much, but it definitely does happen. It happened in Saskatoon, it's happened in Winnipeg, and I suppose I thought, well, if it could happen there, it could certainly happen in Kenora.
And so he's left on this island for how long?
He's there 9 days.
And then I'm trying to figure out now what happens a year later.
He manages to survive the island. He does get off. That's the end of the first section. The second section begins with what's called the retreat. And it's the arrival, it shows the arrival of Lizzie Bird and her family, her parents and her three brothers, as they arrive in Kenora at a place called the retreat, which is a commune in 1974.
So, 74. Some new age deal, right?
Yeah, I suppose you could call that.
Yeah. So back to the 9 days that he spends on the island. Are they harrowing days for him?
Obviously, he at one point is not sure if he's going to survive or not. He manages to kill a few frogs, catch a few fish, eats a bird. That does not. At some point, I think he realizes that he may in fact die. So they are quite harrowing. But something that he also later in the novel does not talk about. And in fact, when he's rescued, he tells people that his boat capsized and he just ended up on the island. So there's a certain shame involved in this having happened to him.
Is it shame because he was dating the white girl, or was it shame that he got hoodwinked by the cop, I guess?
It could be the latter. I don't think he felt any embarrassment or shame in dating the white girl. I think it's, it's an odd thing when you are punished by someone for something you didn't necessarily do that was wrong, and the response is one of, maybe I should feel some sort of shame or embarrassment or chagrin over what happened. And that's, I think, what he's experiencing.
So a year later, Lizzie and her family come to this commune. And how does he meet with them?
He delivers fish. No, he delivers rabbits and chickens to the as meat to the people who live at the retreat. So he brings them food, and while doing that, during that process, at some point he meets Lizzie, and then meets her again, and they begin to spend time together.
What's the family's reaction to the two of them spending time with one another?
Her mother is not as concerned. She's very sort of narcissistic. She takes care of herself, and this is one of the reasons they came out to the retreat, because she is enamored with the doctor who runs the retreat. The father is perhaps a bit more concerned and may give some sort of covert warning to Lizzie that maybe she's going into places she shouldn't go. But it's nothing like, of course, Constable Hart, who had a very, very specific and racist attitude towards it.
So all the while this is going on, there's a protest in the park by mm-hmm. by the Ojibwe.
Yes, it's the it was an actual historical event. It was the occupation of the Anishinaabe Park in Kenora in 1974, and it was a standoff for over a month, and they occupied the park. And it's in the novel, it's somewhat peripheral because it happens, but it's not central to the novel. It's only central in the sense that Raymond sees something in that protest that he feels maybe he should participate in, and so he does.
Now, I'm in my mid-20s, so I wasn't around in 1974.
Right. Right.
This was a significant deal, wasn't it? This was
yeah.
the oak of its time.
That's right. It would have been... There were a few AIM people from the States, the American Indian Movement people, who came up to help with the protest. There were definitely guns involved. There was nobody killed. But it was definitely a protest, and it was nationally known and reported on.
And so Raymond, what's his involvement with them, with the Warriors?
He actually, his job, and this is where the fictional part comes in. I don't know if this was actual fact or not. He delivers food to the people who are in the occupation, participating in the occupation, because they're running short of food. So he brings it in by boat on his in the back way with his boat. So that's his job.
What changed for the Ojibwe after that protest? And do you go into that in the book?
No, I don't go into that. But it's interesting. I did talk to certain people who participated, and I remember one fellow saying to me, he was Ojibwe from Kenora, and he said he was disappointed by the result, and he was also disappointed in the way the leaders handled the occupation, and that they didn't. Demand enough, he felt, or that he felt the result was insufficient.
Did you live near Kenora?
Oh, I live in Winnipeg, which is 2 hours from Kenora, yeah.
In writing this book, did you spend some time there?
Yes, I did. And I'd been there previously, of course. Anybody who lives in Winnipeg has been through Kenora, has spent time in Kenora. So it's, it was part of, some of the summer fabric of my life. So that's definitely... a place that I've been to, and for the novel, I did spend time there and talking to people, etc.
You were born in British Columbia, is that correct?
That's right. I was born in Port Edward, British Columbia. My parents were preacher missionary types who moved around a lot, and that was one of the places they were living at when I was born.
And if we went to Kenora now, where this book is taking place, does it look different than when it did during the book's time?
That's a good question. I mean, in 1974, I was 17. Lizzie's age, actually, and I think it looks very much the same. The Anishinaabe Park is still there. It's a place you can go to. You can have picnics. You can go down to the water, and you can launch boats from there, which people do. It's very much very 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 familiar, and I don't think it's changed a lot.
Well, one of the things that this book discusses is the clash between the two cultures, whites and Indians.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we've come far? And that we can sort of live together comfortably, all Canadians, I suppose.
I doubt that. I think, in particularly in Winnipeg, there's a. I'm very aware of it every day that there's a divide, still a tremendous divide between the Aboriginal population and the white population, and that. And I'm not sure. I have no answers. As a novelist, I wasn't taking on a cause and saying, I was not trying to preach. I was simply presenting a situation that I felt worked within the context of that story. But I think it could also work today in many ways. Absolutely.
What do you think the book says about race? I know that you said you didn't set out to write something to preach or anything, or to perhaps have policy prescriptions, if any. But it obviously mattered to you, didn't it?
Yeah, I think. I mean, it's a story that has sort of been hovering at the edges of my thoughts for many years. Not that particular story, but the idea of. I mean, someone once said to me, "You write a lot of stories about Winnipeg, and you have characters in there, but I've never yet met an Aboriginal character in any of your novels, and that's surprising, given that Winnipeg has a large population." And I guess this was maybe my my response to that comment, because it's true, and it seemed to make sense to bring that into this story. And Kamara is surrounded by over 40 reservations, Aboriginal reservations, so it's definitely a divide there as well.
You grew up a Mennonite, right?
Yeah.
Your parents were, as you mentioned, preachers.
Yeah.
What did that experience growing up with that religion, what did that do for your view of our society here in Canada, of our relationship, sort of, people in Canada with the Aboriginals?
Well, there was a larger Aboriginal population up north as well, too, by Port Edward, Prince Rupert, and that and Japanese. Whites were completely outnumbered. I think one of the reasons I've balked at the faith that I grew up with, or pushed it away in a sense, is that I didn't appreciate its dogmatism, its black and white thinking, and its intolerance for other ways of thinking. And I guess that's one of the things this novel looks at as well. So if that must have even subconsciously informed the story and the writing of this novel.
You've written numerous books, prize winners, bestsellers, and so on. After a while, after you crank out novel after novel, mm-hmm. to sound trite, does it get easier?
I don't think it gets easier. I think in some ways it gets more interesting. I think in some ways I've found a certain freedom in approaching subject matter or topics or characters that I may not have had with my first novel. I think my first novel was an exploration, a more autobiographical one, although it wasn't at all, but it came deeply from where I had grown up. And now I seem to have a greater freedom to just sort of stick my neck out a bit and try other characters from other places, be it a North Vietnamese soldier or a 19-year-old Ojibwe boy.
And I suppose to get published, it's a lot easier when you've had the sort of resume that you've had, right?
Oh, definitely. But I don't know. I don't think one should ever take getting published lightly. I mean, it's always that sort of worry when you hand in a novel that nobody else has read, and what's the response going to be, and is this going to be understood in the way you want it to be, or does it actually work? And so, but yes, definitely, it's much easier now to get published for me than it was when I was 31 years old when I published my first story.
And was that around the age that you started writing?
Yes. Well, no, I started writing much earlier, but it took me 10 years to actually get published.
What did you do before you were a writer?
Oh, I did all kinds of things. I was an orderly. I was an orderly in a hospital. I worked construction. There were numerous things that I did. And then I went into teaching because I needed something stable. I needed a sort of a dependable income. And I taught for many years while I was writing. So it was back and forth, writing, teaching, writing, and, you know, writing late at night and teaching during the day.
And before you started writing sort of professionally or while you were doing all these odd jobs and
right.
so on, how old were you when you knew you wanted to be a writer?
That's a good question. I was a little hesitant to call myself a writer even after I had published my first collection of stories and then my first novel. And I found it much easier to, because I was still a teacher at that point, I found it much easier to fall back on the answer, I'm a teacher, when people would ask me the question, what do you do? I think it was only after my third novel that I finally decided, well, okay, now perhaps I could get away with calling myself a writer. But when I wanted to be a writer, I guess I wanted to at the age of already at 21 when I started to just work at my short stories and then bury them, burn them, throw them out, hide them, but kept trying and just kept going for a fair number of years before I guess I found a tone or a voice that worked for me.
Going back to this point about writing now for you, I'm interested to know, you mentioned that as a writer now you're able to experiment more
mm-hmm.
with characters and so on. Do you think that the novel that you're working on now or the last novel would be better perhaps than your first novel?
Well, I always hope so. I'm not sure if the writer is the best person to make that judgment, but there's always that hope that you can let's say if you compared it to the long jump, and if you jumped a certain amount when you were starting out, and then you eventually got better and better, you'd always hope to jump further until you retired from the long jump. And I guess the metaphor breaks down when the fact becomes evident that writers don't ever retire. So, I mean, it's there's the goal to write perhaps bigger, better, stronger.
How do you write?
On a computer? On a computer.
Yeah.
Well, now that I'm traveling, I have a notebook. Like on the plane today, I sit down and I write into the notebook, and then I'll transcribe it later.
And I guess it's easier for a writer to write on a computer, is it? Revisions and so on.
I would say it's a rather a blessing for me, who's quite a disorganized person, and that in the past, before the computer, I would have just reams of coiled notebooks that I'd have to go through to figure out where the story was or which draft I was in, and this way, with a computer, of course, everything is much more organized. I have, I just number my drafts, and then I know where I am.
So do you write all the time then, even on this, you mentioned you're on the plane, you're writing. Do you find that you're working on something all the time?
I do. I even if it's not specific scenes, I'll take notes. If I'm reading a book and I come across an idea, I'll write that down. Yeah, so it's always there. But in this case, I'm trying to get into, I'm finding my way into a new novel, so that's why I'm spending more time with you on the airplane. Writing,
and how the importance of reading in your life as a writer. Do you find that you read more than perhaps say the average person?
Well, I think more than the average person, because I think unfortunately there aren't enough readers in the world, and a lot of if the majority of people read fiction, for example, I'd probably be I'd be able to support myself much better. But I find reading to be absolutely essential to the writing process. In fact, I think it's first you're a reader and then you're a writer.
How long did the retreat take you to write?
3 years.
And are you working on that the whole 3 years, or are you working on other things at the same time?
I write a short story now and then. I might write an article that someone's asked me to write, but for the most part, I consider myself a novel writer. That's what's important right now, and it's the best way to pay the bills. And so I work at what pays the bills, and that's novels.
You mentioned that you don't like to judge your work in terms of what your last novel being better than the first or second novel.
Right.
When you're writing a book, when you're writing a novel, when do you know that it's good, or when do you at what point do you know that this is we're going to submit this now? We're going to give this to the I guess your agent or your representatives.
Yeah. That's really tough. I mean, I think there's always self-doubt involved, and one day you might think this is just incredibly brilliant, and then the next day you'll go back to it and think, well, that was garbage. And so there's, but at some point, the story, for me, the engine of the story kicks in, or it starts, and then it almost takes on a life of its own, and I can feel it, for me, I'm just talking about for me, in my body, I can feel the sense of the thrill I evaluate it and I say, well, it's not even an evaluation, it's just I have a deeper sense that this is actually working, and then you know that the story is probably a good one.
And that's the drive, right? That's I guess the competitive nature of it, because writing is so solitary. Do you find that you're competitive with other writers or with yourself perhaps more?
I think more with myself. I think I've always strived. And this comes back to, do you write a better novel each novel? I aim for that, definitely. I definitely aim for that, and that's sort of the competitive nature. I sort of compete with my last book, and I say, well, I did that, let's try something else, and let's try to write the best book possible. And of course, Samuel Beckett said, if you fail, just go out and fail better. And I think for every subsequent novel, it's the sort of drive to fail better.
And you've been nominated, you've won numerous prizes. How does that factor in your work? Does that motivate you perhaps, or is that part of the competition, do you suppose?
Well, writers want to be loved, right? I mean, like everybody, and it's there's a big ego involved, and the trick is to sort of shunt the ego aside, and this desire for love aside, and push yourself to write the best book possible. I don't. Prizes and awards are very arbitrary. They're very, very dependent on the makeup of a jury, or the mood of a jury, or whether you've made friends or made enemies. And it's sometimes they're political. So you take the good stuff when you get it, and when you don't get it, you say, well, I'm going to, you know, I know it's a crapshoot, and I'm going to go out and write another novel.
I've enjoyed talking to you today, David, about your work and about this book. Continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
The book is called The Retreat, 3299, from McClelland and Stewart. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Bonner.